Welcome to NTD Evening News, our top story tonight. When should presidents have immunity for their actions? At the Supreme Court, justices hammer former President Trump's attorney. Most seem skeptical of the argument, but it remains unclear when the high court will rule. Arlene Richards has the details. Trump's former attorney Rudy Giuliani indicted, along with over a dozen others, for allegedly working to overturn the 2020 election in Arizona. Jeremy Sandberg reports. Former President Trump speaking out after day 7 of his criminal trial in Manhattan. Iris Tao has the latest on witness testimony and how Trump plans to make a play to win New York in 2024. Protests continue on university campuses across the country. The University of Southern California joins in, leading to several arrests and the cancellation of a graduation ceremony. Families and friends of hostages hit the streets after Hamas releases a disturbing video of a hostage. And after 2 weeks of no attacks, the Houthis say they are at it again. Jason Perry reports.
This is NTD Evening News, live from our NTD global headquarters in New York City. Here is Tiffany Meyer.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us tonight. The Supreme Court today considered arguments on whether a former president should have absolute immunity from criminal prosecution. Several of the justices appeared likely to reject the claim. NTD's Arlene Richards has more.
We will hear argument this morning in case 23939, Trump versus United States.
A majority of Supreme Court justices on Thursday seem poised to reject former President Trump's sweeping claim that he is immune from criminal prosecution. But the timing of their decision remains unclear. Trump's attorney, D. John Sauer, appealed two lower court decisions that ruled the former president could be charged, like any other defendant, for allegedly attempting to overturn the 2020 election results. Sauer said in opening statements that presidential immunity was paramount.
Without presidential immunity from criminal prosecution, there can be no presidency as we know it. For 234 years of American history, no president was ever prosecuted for his official acts.
He argued that prosecuting a president for his official acts was not supported by history or tradition. Despite Sauer's argument for absolute immunity, several justices focused on distinguishing official acts from private acts.
I'm having a hard time thinking that creating false documents, that submitting false documents, that ordering the assassination of a rival, that accepting a bribe, and countless other laws that could be broken for personal gain, that anyone would say that it would be reasonable for a president or any public official to do that.
Your Honor, as this court said very persuasively in Fitzgerald, the allegation that this particular act would be done for an unlawful purpose or was unlawful could be made in every case. And therefore, if that were the doctrine, that the allegation of improper purpose is what deprives the objective acts of their immunity, then the immunity would have no purchase.
Sauer conceded that private acts would not be protected by immunity. Some conservative justices signaled that the case might have to be sent back to the lower court to distinguish official acts from private in the indictment, which could further delay the trial, something special counsel Jack Smith has been arguing against. Justices could make a decision at any time between now and July. The later they decide, the more likely the trial will be delayed. Arlene Richards, NTD News.
Meanwhile, outside the Supreme Court, protesters gathering behind the barricade. NTD's Sam Wong was in the crowd to find out what they had to say about Trump's immunity case.
And what are you here for today?
A lot of reasons. I like to bring peace. I get people singing and dancing together, except I'm being bombarded by this lady. But I do want to show support for Donald Trump. He's going to win this case. He's going to win all four of his cases.
And I see you got Jack Smith on your beanie right now. And tell us what that's about.
Yeah, Merrick Garland, the patriarchy, is responsible for this delay in this thing. So finally, after all that time, nearly 2 years, Jack Smith is the person responsible, and I'm all here for it.
So do you think the president should be immune from prosecution?
All presidents are. But there is a process called impeachment. They made two attempts. He was acquitted both times.
There should not be complete immunity. If it was, then we basically would be like Russia.
The man, his entire life, from the one he was a five-year-old, he was throwing rocks at a baby. You know, he's evaded responsibility throughout his 77 years.
I see on your signs here, it says, cuckoo, toxic loser. So what's that all about?
Cuckoo, you know that colloquialism?
Now, if Trump won and he started attacking Biden, you watch them get how mad they'll get if the tables are turned. Trump won't do that.
It's obvious that the American people really do love Donald Trump and that it'll be a landslide, as he puts it.
Former Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani was indicted in Arizona yesterday for allegedly seeking to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in the state. He's among 18 people charged with illegally claiming electoral votes for former President Trump. NTD's Jeremy Sandberg has the story.
An indictment unsealed Wednesday accuses Giuliani and other Trump allies of attempting to pressure election officials in several states to overturn the election won by President Biden. The papers also list, quote, a former U.S. president, a likely reference to Trump, although he was not indicted. The indictment names 11 defendants and redacts the names of seven others. The attorney general stated the names would be made public once all the defendants had been served. The indictment says the named defendants acted as pro-Trump fake electors from Arizona. In 2020, the 11 Republican electors said they were duly elected in a fair process. They said the votes they cast were procedural votes meant to preserve Trump's claim to the presidency in case he won legal challenges to Biden's election, and not an attempt to illegally overturn the election. Giuliani's spokesperson confirmed that Giuliani's name was one of those redacted, but he is easily identifiable from his description as the mayor, who presided over a hearing in Phoenix in 2020 where he alleged negligence from election officials. Giuliani's spokesperson called the indictment an example of weaponization of the justice system that does irrevocable harm to the country. Another defendant whose name was redacted is described as chief of staff in 2020, the position Mark Meadows held at the time. Trump, Giuliani, and Meadows are co-defendants in Georgia, where they're charged with conspiring to overturn Biden's election victory in the state. They have pleaded not guilty there. Speaking after the indictment was unsealed, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays alleged the defendants schemed to overturn a free and fair election.
Whatever their reasoning was, the plot to violate the law must be answered for, and I was elected to uphold the law of this state.
Governor Katie Hobbs weighed in, calling the alleged actions shameful.
As Secretary of State, I oversaw free, fair, secure elections in Arizona and defended the votes of millions of Arizonans. I am confident that Attorney General Mays conducted a fair and impartial investigation and grand jury process, and now the justice system will do its job.
The so-called fake elector plan plays a prominent role in the federal case against Trump, brought by Special Counsel Jack Smith. Smith is accusing Trump of orchestrating a grand scheme to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Jeremy Sandberg, NTD News.
And in New York, Trump has just finished day seven of his alleged campaign finance violation trial. His team seeking to prove that Trump committed no crime as they cross-examine the prosecution's first witness. NTD's White House correspondent Iris Tao was at the courthouse in Manhattan.
Over the past few days, Trump has been voicing frustration over the New York judge's decision that made him stay here in New York instead of being able to attend the oral arguments in front of the Supreme Court. But today, on his way out of the courthouse, Trump says he's actually glad that he's forced to be here, as it was an interesting day in court.
Amazing testimony. This is a trial that should have never happened. This is a case that should have never been filed. An incredible day. Open your eyes.
At today's court proceeding, former tabloid executive David Pecker was testifying about an alleged scheme involving Trump and former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen to buy and then bury negative stories that he said could hurt Trump's 2016 campaign. But Trump's lawyers, when questioning Pecker, suggested that such so-called catch and kill deals are just standard practice at the publisher and were not criminal. Pecker also admitted himself that he would do the same thing for celebrities, again adding to Trump's team's defense that it's not a conspiracy or a crime related to Trump. Meanwhile, as the Biden campaign has been mocking Trump for being stuck at a courthouse, and Trump has been using his court appearances to campaign and talk to voters. And just this morning, Trump addressed the latest GDP news, previewed his rallies in New York City, and also talked to construction workers in Manhattan around 6 a.m. this morning. Watch.
We're gonna run very hard in New York. New York, we have a good chance of winning New York, in my opinion, but we're going to give it a shot.
And Trump also reacting to the Supreme Court oral arguments, calling them monumental.
Here, I hope it was made clear that a president has to have immunity.
And on Friday, we're going to see a big split-screen moment as President Biden will also be in New York City as Trump begins day 8 of his criminal trial. Reporting from New York City, Aris Tao, NTD News.
Disgraced Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein had his 2020 rape conviction overturned by a New York appeals court. During a press conference outside of the courthouse today, lawyers for Weinstein said he was found guilty because he was unpopular.
And in this courthouse behind us at that trial, the law was not applied fairly to Harvey Weinstein. And what the Court of Appeals, the highest court in the greatest state, in the greatest country, said today is that, yes, no one is above the law, but no one is below the law either.
Weinstein's conviction was thrown out on a technicality by the court's 4-3 majority. The appellate justices say the trial should not have included testimony of alleged prior sexual acts. Weinstein will remain in prison while he awaits a new trial in New York. He was convicted of another rape in Los Angeles in 2022. Weinstein's critics note the ruling is based on legal technicalities and not an exoneration of Weinstein's behavior. The University of Southern California announced restrictions at its campus following a large anti-Israel protest that ended with nearly 100 arrests. NTD's Christina Corona has more from the university.
We're here in University Park, down the street from USC, where hundreds of pro-Palestinian protesters crowded the school yesterday, resulting in 93 individuals being arrested for trespassing. Demonstrators, including many who were unassociated with the university, set up tents and demanded an end to the war in Gaza. Tensions rose when campus police requested removal of the tents, which violate campus regulations. Officers in riot gear dispersed the crowd following a 4 p.m. order. No injuries were reported.
The university is a private campus, and the group had been violating some of their orders, and it was a trespass at that point, and we assisted with those arrests.
USC's Department of Public Safety responded by announcing campus closure on X. The protest on the UPC has ended. However, the campus remains closed until further notice. Students, faculty, staff, and people with business on campus may enter with proper identification. One resident said,
I noticed right away that how important it is that we American citizens, voting citizens, raise our voices in demonstrations, especially when it comes to our government funding countries that are in need a lot of weapons.
While visiting the campus, he observed the heightened security.
The campus was not that filled with students. Students were running around. I noticed immediately I was in eye contact with a security officer across the crossing, 100 meters away. And he already noticed that I'm not a student from a USC campus. And I was asked for my ID. And of course, I showed him my ID and it was no trouble.
This demonstration comes after the university's controversial decision to exclude pro-Palestinian valedictorian Osna Tabassum from speaking at commencement due to allegations of anti-Semitism. The school cited concerns for her safety and expressed the need for prioritizing community protection over freedom of expression. Following the heated protest, USC announced Thursday their main graduation ceremony, which brings in 65,000 friends and families, will not be held. The school plans to release more details about commencement no later than April 30th. Authorities said anyone arriving on campus will have to show proper identification. The LAPD said patrols will be visible around the campus Thursday and Friday. Christina Corona, NTD News, Los Angeles.
Students stormed a university building in New York City, protesting the university's handling of anti-Israeli protests. Protesters were holding up banners saying it doesn't end with a ceasefire. Here's what one had to say.
Immediate ceasefire, of course, but the ultimate solution is you can't oppress a people. It's ungodly, and God warns us that if you do such a thing, it will bring to catastrophic results by doing such an injustice.
He argued that current anti-Israel protests are anti-Zionist instead of anti-Semitic in nature. But the World Jewish Congress identifies anti-Zionism as the latest form of anti-Semitism. It says anti-Zionism is used as a tool to ignore blatant anti-Jewish hatred and often leads to violence. Families and friends of hostages protested in Israel today after Hamas released a disturbing video. Meanwhile, after 2 weeks without incident, Yemen's Houthi terrorist group says it's resumed its attacks in the Red Sea. NTD's Jason Perry has the latest and a warning. This report contains footage that some viewers may find disturbing.
On Thursday in Israel, families and friends of hostages protested and demanded that the Israeli government reach a deal to free the hostages.
I understand that from the other end there is the Hamas terrorist organization. There is in war that doesn't want to bring back our people, and they are monsters. I know we are dealing with monsters, and I understand it's really hard.
Also on Thursday, the United States and 17 other countries urged Hamas to release the hostages. This comes just a day after Hamas released a disturbing video of an Israeli-American hostage who was kidnapped on October 7th and is now missing part of his arm. In the video, he told his parents he loves them and misses them. And his parents sent this message shortly after the video was released.
Hirsch, if you can hear this, we heard your voice today for the first time in 201 days. And if you can hear us, I am telling you, we are telling you, we love you, stay strong, survive.
They also called on all parties involved in the ceasefire negotiations to reach a deal to free the hostages. On that same day, a Hamas official in Turkey said Hamas wants a complete end to the war before they will release the hostages. And when an Israeli government spokesperson was asked about a ceasefire deal on Thursday, he put the blame on Hamas.
They walk away from any potential deal, even though Israel has really gone to extreme efforts to try and get our people home.
Meanwhile, the Iran-backed Houthi terrorist group in Yemen continues to attack ships in the Red Sea that it says are linked to Israel and the United States. However, most of the ships targeted by the Houthis have had little or no direct connection to either country. And after 2 weeks of no attacks, the terrorist group on Wednesday reported attacking two American ships and an Israeli vessel. The Houthi terrorist group says it will continue its attacks until Israel ends the war in the Gaza Strip. Jason Perry, NTD News.
Coming up, 25 years since a peaceful appeal in China. Falun Gong practitioners are still heavily persecuted by the communist regime. Our guest explains to us what happened on April 25, 1999, and why the event is so significant. And new numbers show about half of Americans are in support of mass deportations of illegal immigrants. This includes a surprisingly high number of Democrats. Details when we come back. Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. A quarter century of oppression. Today marks the 25th anniversary of a peaceful appeal to the Chinese Communist Party. The regime twisted the events of that day to try to legitimize a brutal persecution of Falun Gong practitioners around the world. Falun Gong, also known as Falun Dafa, is a spiritual practice that teaches slow-moving energy exercises and moral improvement. To reflect on the April 25th appeal and its significance, earlier we spoke with Levi Browdy, executive director of the Falun Dafa Information Center. Levi Browdy, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you back on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, Levi, to begin, what led to these 10,000 practitioners of Falun Gong gathering that day? What were the events ahead of this?
Well, I think that's an important question because that's where a lot of people get things wrong. I mean, the common narrative that it was rather a sudden event that was kind of surrounding the government central compound there in Beijing. And that's wrong on several different fronts. And the first thing to understand is the background of what was happening in the time leading up to that. And I think there's two points to make there. One is to understand that, you know, back in the 90s, in this time, throughout the 90s, actually, Falun Gong was widely popular, supported by the government. It was sort of everywhere in China. But the CCP is not necessarily a monolith. And so as Falun Gong's popularity was really growing, its main book was a bestseller in 1996, there were factions within the CCP that did start to attack Falun Gong in news articles, open up investigations where, and it's clearly, if you look at the record, it's clear that they had come up with a conclusion, let's find something wrong with Falun Gong, and then they'd start the investigation. And so these kind of things were happening as early as the latter part of 1996 and sort of going on in 97, 98. And so by the time we get to the spring of 1999, in the nearby city of Tianjin, another one of these articles kind of attacking Falun Gong in sort of a political way was published on April 11th. And so as some Falun Gong practitioners had been doing to previously attack articles in China over the last few years, they went to Tianjin. But what was different this time is that those practitioners were beaten, they were thrown in prison. That was something that was new. That had never happened before. And so a lot of the Falun Gong practitioners in the area became concerned. They wanted to go to Tianjin and talk to the paper and trying to figure out what the misunderstanding was. And they were told by government officials, no, don't come to Tianjin. Go to the appeals office in Beijing. And so that's a key thing that most people miss. There were factions within the CCP that were telling the Falun Gong practitioners, go to Beijing, go to Beijing. And so on April 25th, the word got around, and you have actually more than 10,000 Falun Gong practitioners going to the appeals office, which is the normal place that you go to when you have a grievance with the government. It happens to be adjacent to Zhongnanhai, the central leadership of the Communist Party. And so that's really how this event unfolded. It had a background in this kind of negativity that some of these factions were doing for a few years. And essentially Falun Gong was told to go to Beijing on that day.
Now, jumping out a bit, what is the significance of this day, April 25th, to Americans? Why should we care here?
Two points. One is the CCP. I think what really comes out of April 25th is the idea that, you know, at least factions within the CCP pretty much orchestrated this event. You know, again, as they've been doing investigations, it was sort of the latest in an effort to try and provoke Falun Gong, in trying to create an event where they can go after Falun Gong. And so it was a real lesson in terms of the nature of the CCP and some of the conniving that they do and some of the backroom politicking they do when there's factions that want to secure power. And a lot of the persecution of Falun Gong, tragically, is really about a faction within the CCP, in the CCP trying to secure power. So that's one lesson. I think the other lesson to really learn is to understand what Falun Gong was really doing on that day. This was not a besieging of the compound, as the CCP says, and it wasn't even a protest, as a lot of the Western media had portrayed it. It really was Falun Gong practitioners thinking this whole thing was a big misunderstanding, because the only way they could conceive of the Chinese regime doing something negative to them is just they didn't understand them. And so this whole thing was a very peaceful attempt just to go to the appeals office to explain themselves. And I think that shows a lot about where Falun Gong was coming from.
Now, you mentioned the persecution against the Falun Gong, and many see this day, April 25th, as kind of setting the stage for the persecution that came following that. What has that persecution looked like since then?
Well, starting in July, really July 20th, the early morning hours of July 20th of 1999, the CCP unleashed a violent nationwide campaign to completely eradicate Falun Gong, in their own words, eradicate Falun Gong. And that has meant, at this point over the last 25 years, millions of Falun Gong practitioners detained or imprisoned throughout China. We know of over 5,000 people that have been killed from torture, and those are just a few that we've been able to verify the details of. And according to the China Tribunal that convened in London a few years ago, tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, have been killed to extract their organs and fuel the forced organ harvesting business. And so the impact is, it's hard to overstate in terms of the amount of suffering that has unveiled, the tearing apart of families and communities for the last quarter century.
On that note, what does this day, April 25th, signify to the Falun Gong practitioners, especially those around the world who are able to either rally or stand up for their faith without ending up in jail like they would in China?
I think it's, for many, it's an emotional day because it was the first time that Falun Gong practitioners, even under the threat that we had talked about that was happening during the spring of 1999, came forth and just on their faith and their conviction that what they were doing was right, stand up and willing to engage with the Chinese regime and trying to explain themselves. There was I think that that's something very precious among the Falun Gong community that looks at that as that set the tone for not only what was happening in China but worldwide on peacefully appealing not only initially to the Chinese regime, eventually to the international community, to let them know what we are all about and how horrific this persecution is. That was really the start. That was the first event that really started that. And so it really is the catalyst for all of the peaceful civil disobedience that has since taken place inside China and the peaceful demonstrations that have been going on around the world.
Levi Browdy, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Tiffany.
New numbers show about half of Americans are in support of mass deportations of illegal immigrants, including many Democrats. This as more states are taking measures to fight illegal immigration.
A new Harris poll conducted for Axios released on Thursday shows that 51% of Americans support mass deportations of illegal immigrants. Not just Republicans, but also 42% of Democrats say they'd support that. Former President Trump has repeatedly called for such mass deportations. For example, earlier this month, he addressed the crisis while speaking in Michigan.
On day one, I will seal the border and we'll begin the largest domestic deportation operation in the history of our country. And if other countries say they won't take them back, we're not going to take them back, I will say that, here they come. You're just going to hold on to your britches, because here they come. They're coming back.
President Biden says Trump doesn't support an immigration bill that stalled in Congress. But the new poll found that 32% of people say it's Biden who is most responsible for the crisis. This outranks any other political or structural factor. Meanwhile, Oklahoma is on track to become the latest state to make a law addressing illegal immigration. It's similar to the high-profile law in Texas, and it would make it a state crime for illegal immigrants to enter Oklahoma. A first offense is a misdemeanor, punishable by up to 1 year in a county jail, a fine of up to $500, or both. Additional offenses are felonies, punishable by up to 2 years in prison, a fine of up to $1,000, or both. The law passed the state Senate on Tuesday and the state House last week. Governor Kevin Stitt commented on it a few days ago.
We have to stop the flow of the mass migration coming into the U.S. We don't have the resources to take care of and give free medical care. We do that with our U.S. citizens. We don't have the resources to do that.
The governor is expected to sign the bill into law. And Oklahoma would be at least the third state to enact such a law. Earlier this month, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signed a similar bill. That law would prohibit state entry for individuals who've previously been denied admission into the U.S.
Coming up, the Supreme Court has to decide whether former President Trump enjoys immunity from criminal prosecution. The former Clinton impeachment manager joins us to explore this historic hearing. And CPAC Hungary kicking off today in Budapest. It's one of the largest gatherings of conservatives internationally. Luis Martinez has more on the event after the break. Welcome back. If you're just joining us now, here are some today's top headlines. Police arrested hundreds of people at anti-Israel campus protests across the nation. The University of Southern California canceled its main commencement ceremony over security concerns. The New York Appeals Court overturned Harvey Weinstein's 2020 rape conviction. The court said witnesses should not have talked about unproven allegations and ordered a new trial. Weinstein remains in prison for a separate rape conviction. A grand jury in Arizona indicted 18 people, including Trump advisors, for their efforts challenging the 2020 presidential election. They include former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, lawyer Rudy Giuliani, and the 11 alternate Republican electors. Trump was in a New York courtroom for day 7 of his campaign finance hush money trial. His lawyers cross-examined the prosecution's first witness, former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments over Trump's claim to presidential immunity. The justices grappled with what counts as an official act and what counts as a private act. American and European conservatives share common concerns over elections, immigration, and the war in Ukraine. Our correspondent Luis Martinez is in Budapest, Hungary, with the latest from CPAC 2024.
Conservatives in Europe and the United States know that 2024 is a crucial year, with over 4 billion people in over 60 countries heading to the booths to elect government officials. Most notably in the European Union in June, they will have parliamentary elections that will determine the composition of the EU Parliament for the next 5 years. And in November, the United States will hold presidential elections. Let's listen to what Prime Minister Viktor Orban had to say about the electoral cycle this year.
I am very hopeful that in the future, instead of all sorts of NGOs and large corporations and media centers and suspicious experts and suspicious academicians, it will be popularly elected representatives and politicians who will chart the course to walk on.
I spoke with Gavin Wax, the president of the New York's Young Republican Club, and he believes this year Republicans and conservatives will vote for politicians who are willing to enact the policies that they campaign on.
And listen, I think we've had many decades of very weak and feckless and frankly milquetoast Republican leadership. I think a lot of people have been disappointed, you know, in terms of Republicans delivering on their message, delivering on their campaign promises, and they're looking for more aggressive forms of conservatism. They're looking for more populist energy. They're looking for people that are willing to push the envelope, to use state power, to actually enact their agenda, not just talk about it.
Another issue of common concern among conservatives worldwide is immigration. I spoke with Colombian Senator Maria Fernanda Cabal, and she highlighted the weaponization of immigration by criminal enterprises.
Mass migration has turned to be a weapon against the free world because, of course, you cannot hide there's an economic necessity of people. But that's a motive that is used by all these smugglers. Then you see Chinese people and Chinese smugglers. This is, at the end, a criminal transnational organization.
It is worth noting that there are some important differences in between Americans and Europeans when it comes to the Ukraine war, particularly here in Hungary, because Hungary has borders with Ukraine.
There will be no solution on the battlefield for this war. And as an outcome, Europe, the European economy, suffers a lot because of this war. Should there be peace, at least ceasefire and peace talks, that would be better not only for Europe, but for the U.S. as well, in my eyes, because the U.S. is interested in a strong Europe.
While European and American conservatives have market differences when it comes to the Ukraine war, they also have market similarities when it comes to TikTok. Over 10 countries in the European Union have restricted, one way or another, the social media app. Reporting from Budapest, Hungary, Luis Eduardo Martinez, NTD News.
Joining me now to discuss Trump's immunity case before the Supreme Court is Bob Barr, former congressman, attorney, and Clinton impeachment manager. Congressman, good to see you again. Thanks for joining us. Now, the justices seem skeptical that former President Trump should receive absolute criminal immunity, but appear to be open to allowing some level of immunity for presidents. What do you make of today's arguments and the justices' response?
It was actually one of the most interesting arguments that I've ever heard. I'm, of course, much older than you are, and I remember the Nixon, the Watergate scandal, in which Nixon was very nearly impeached back in the early 1970s. And I think the problem with Nixon is haunting us here today from the standpoint that very clearly Nixon would have been prosecuted for crimes that he committed while president, but after he resigned the presidency. Those cases were never tried, and of course, therefore, the issue of presidential immunity, which was perfectly encapsulated in that instance, never came up because President Ford pardoned President Nixon. So the Supreme Court really, for the last 5 decades now, has never really addressed this issue. The arguments today were extremely interesting. I don't think, as you indicated, that the Supreme Court will go along with either side completely. The real question, I think, from a practical standpoint is, will they make any decision or simply kick it back to the lower courts for a resolution, which would then make it virtually impossible from a practical standpoint to have resolution of the case before the election in November?
And now the core arguments this morning seem to boil down to a president's official act versus private acts in regards to Trump's actions during the 2020 election. Help us understand why the justices are honing in on this distinction.
It's a very good question because the Constitution doesn't talk about official or unofficial acts. The magic of our Constitution is the fact that unlike most other constitutions or operative governing documents in other countries, our Constitution doesn't tell us exactly what government should do. It doesn't tell us exactly what the president should do. It simply sets the parameters for governing and then spends most of its time, particularly the Bill of Rights, for example, telling us what government can't do. So it's a practical question. Other than when the president does something as commander-in-chief, and there is a lot of case law on that, when a president does something that could cross the line from legal to criminal act, you really have not much to go on. Common sense, though, tells us that if a president is performing an official act, he should not be held liable for it. But what is an official act? Most of the examples that we heard today from both the justices asking questions as well as the lawyers providing legal arguments dealt with issues that are pretty easy to distinguish, the Iraq War, for example. But what we're looking at here is a much different issue. It is specific acts by a specific president that appear to fall outside of his official duties. So I think that the Mr. Smith has a good argument in that, but whether or not he'll be able to present his case before the election is very problematic because the indictment that he's proceeding on is sort of a bowl of both official acts and unofficial acts.
And now, Congressman, this clip is making the rounds on X, where Justice Samuel Alito asks DOJ Attorney Michael Dreeben about fears over groundless prosecution not supported by evidence. Let's listen to that now.
You had a lot of experience in the Justice Department. You come across a lot of cases where the U.S. attorney or another federal prosecutor really wanted to indict a case and the grand jury refused to do so.
There are such cases.
Yeah,
Yes. But I think that the other
every
level
once in a while there's an eclipse too.
Well, I think that's for the most reason is prosecutors have no incentive to bring a case to a grand jury and secure an indictment when they don't have evidence to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
Congressman, what do you make of this argument by the DOJ attorney?
Well, I was a U.S. attorney for a number of years under Presidents Reagan and Bush one, and both in that capacity and as a defense attorney, and I've handled a number of criminal cases in the private sector, the vast majority of prosecutors, and that includes federal prosecutors, don't present cases to a grand jury unless there is sufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, when a prosecutor presents a case to a grand jury, the grand jury doesn't have to find that potential defendant committed the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a jury, a petit jury responsibility. But a prosecutor has to have a sound case, and only an irresponsible prosecutor would present a case to a grand jury that he or she didn't believe that they could win. So very rarely do you have a rogue prosecutor. It does happen. We're dealing perhaps with that here in Georgia in the state case against President Trump. But the vast majority, almost to a person, of federal prosecutors are very solid from the standpoint of making sure that they have good evidence to present to a grand jury in order to secure an indictment.
And finally, how could the outcome of this case impact Trump's other cases, including those in Georgia, Florida, and New York?
Only from a scheduling standpoint, I think. The issues in the Florida case, of course, are very different, dealing with acts that the president took after he left office, that is, taking documents to which he arguably was not entitled, and then obstructing efforts by the FBI to access those documents. So that's a very different case. And the case in Georgia and the one ongoing in New York deal not with violations of federal law, but state law. So I don't think that the case today will really have much to do with the other cases, but it is a fundamentally important case because at long last, 50 years or so after we probably should have had these issues addressed with President Nixon, it looks like we finally may have some answers to, you know, that historical question. Can a president or a former president be prosecuted for acts that he took during his presidency?
Bob Barr, former congressman, attorney, and Clinton impeachment manager, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Has the world forgotten October 7th, Israel's 9/11? Kelly Wright traveled to Israel to speak to survivors and hostages' family members. They vow never to forget as they combat anti-Semitism and fight for freedom. Watch Hope for Israel, an NTD News primetime special on Friday, April 26th at 10 p.m. Eastern here on NTD. Coming up, Southwest Airlines is ending service at four airports. The carrier reports losing more than $200 million in the first quarter. And in football news, the first round of the NFL draft starts tonight. Dave Martin joins us to discuss who will be picked first when we come back. Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. The airline industry feeling the pain from Boeing's safety crisis. Southwest is ending service at four airports as it takes a hit to its bottom line. NTD's Virginia Gibson has more.
Boeing safety trouble sending shockwaves across the industry. American Airlines CEO Robert Isom delivers a stern message to the plane maker.
Get your act together. And it starts with producing quality products one at a time off the assembly line. Get back to the basics.
Isom says he'll buy fewer Boeing aircraft than previously projected because of the safety issues. American lost $226 million in the first quarter compared to making a profit of $33 million in the same quarter last year.
I can't tell you if they're making progress or not because it's all actions that matter, not words. And we're continuing to work with them. We'll do everything we can to support Boeing. We need them to be successful in the long run.
Higher fuel costs also hit earnings. Southwest Airlines also reporting earnings today, seeing a loss this quarter of $231 million. This loss is bigger than losses in the same quarter last year. Previously, Southwest expected to receive 46 Boeing planes. Now it's receiving less than half of that. The airline is resorting to older planes and cutting staff to save money. It expects to end the year with 2,000 fewer employees. This comes as flight attendants Wednesday voted for a 22% pay raise. Out of 20,000 flight attendants, 81% voted on getting this raise immediately. Southwest says it's thrilled to have an agreement with its flight attendants. Virginia Gibson, NTD News.
And now for your sports news, we're joined by NTD's Dave Martin at the Sports Hub. Dave, plenty to discuss today, but let's start in Hollywood, where actor Owen Wilson reportedly turned down a lucrative opportunity to star in a movie called Juice about the late NFL star O.J. Simpson. What was it about the movie that Wilson objected to?
Yeah, it was the premise. You know, Wilson reportedly had a meeting with the producers to discuss the part. They offered him a hefty $12 million to play the lead role, but apparently he hadn't quite read the script yet. When he found out what the premise was, he declined. Now, specifically, Owen said, quote, "If you think I'm going to take the lead role in a movie about how O.J. didn't do it, you've got to be kidding me," end quote. Now, the lead role he was offered was to play attorney Douglas McCann, who investigated a number of leads. Some might call them conspiracy theories over who could have committed the murders of O.J.'s ex-wife and friend. In any case, the movie is already in production. It's supposed to be ready by October 3rd, which would be the 29th anniversary of O.J.'s acquittal.
Now, over in golf news, Tiger Woods' 15-year-old son, Charlie, played in a U.S. Open qualifier today, but failed to advance, shooting an 81. Now, had he advanced, would he have been able to compete against his dad at the actual U.S. Open?
Well, he would have been on his way anyway. There's two qualifiers you have to advance through to get there. He was playing in the first one today. Now fans don't really realize that the U.S. Open is actually an open championship, so it's open to all. But you have to begin with a handicap of less than 0.4 to qualify for the first of two qualifiers, which is an 18-hole event, which is what Charlie was doing today. Now, just under 900 of approximately 10,000 advanced to the next qualifier, a 36-hole event. Last year, only 64 of those advanced to the U.S. Open. Now, Tiger Woods himself, he will actually get an exemption this year to play in the U.S. Open, but it would have been quite a story if he could have played with his son.
Well, shifting gears to football, the NFL draft starts tonight. Some years there seems to be a consensus number one pick that every team wants. Is this one of those years?
Yeah, I think no matter who has the first overall pick, they are taking quarterback Caleb Williams out of USC. He's a 2022 Heisman Trophy winner. The guy makes all the throws. He can extend plays with his legs. He knows how to read defenses, although that gets a lot tougher in the NFL. But another player who's going to be picked high, I believe, is going to be Marvin Harrison Jr., widely believed to be the best receiver in the draft. Excellent route runner, great speed, great pedigree, too. His dad actually is a Hall of Fame receiver for the Indianapolis Colts for about a dozen years. I think he goes fourth overall to Arizona. Now, a third player I want to look at, Brock Bowers, tight end of Georgia. The guy is maybe a bit small for a tight end. Most tight ends are like 6'5", 6'6", but the guy is like a wide receiver basically in a tight end's body. Won two championships at Georgia. I think he'd go as high as number 10 to the New York Jets for Aaron Rodgers to give him someone to throw to.
Now, looking at the draft order, the Chicago Bears seem to have quite an advantage here with both the first and ninth overall picks. How do they end up with that good fortune?
Yeah, this is from a trade last year. The Chicago Bears got this number one overall pick from Carolina, and this is their ninth overall pick themselves. Carolina, unfortunately, had a horrible year this year, 2-15. So, unfortunately, the draft order is the reverse of how you finished. They were last, so unfortunately, this goes to the Bears. Bears have two of the top nine picks. I think they're going to have a really good night tonight, unfortunately, at Carolina's expense.
Well, Dave, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steph.
And that's all for today's news. For round-the-clock coverage, visit us at ntd.com or download our NTD app. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Good night.